the new theater of the mind. The Bruce Collins Show.
Welcome back to the Bruce Collins Show. We're very glad to have you join us. Our guests tonight are Lowell Ponte and Mary Sutherland. Lowell Ponte has co-authored the book, Don't Bank on It. And Mary Sutherland talks about her research into red-haired giants. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Friday night at midnight right here at WWPR, 1490 AM. You can listen to past archives of The Bruce Collins Show at ipbn-fm.com. That's ipbn-fm.com. There's a banner just for The Bruce Collins Show on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network website. Click on the show banner and you will go right to our page. We would appreciate it if you're able to spread the word for our show by word of mouth, social media, or in whatever creative way you can. Also, we have a Facebook page for The Bruce Collins Show. Please like us there. And you can email the show at bruce_collins_show@aol.com. The Bruce Collins Show also has a YouTube channel. Visit YouTube, search for The Bruce Collins Show channel, subscribe, and catch all the latest shows on YouTube. Again, our guests are Lowell Ponte, co-author of the book Don't Bank on It, and Mary Sutherland, the original researcher into the red-haired giants, in a moment. And joining me this week is Lowell Ponte. Lowell Ponte's diverse background includes being a reporter in Washington, D.C., a legislative aide in the California Assembly, one of two co-owners of a successful Hollywood public relations firm, a consultant and speaker for various corporations and trade associations, and dean of a distance learning university. He worked for 15 years as a roving editor for Reader's Digest magazine. He has done reporting in 33 countries from Indonesia and Israel to communist Cuba. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and many other publications. Lowell Ponte is a native of Southern California and has hosted talk radio shows in Los Angeles for 17 years. More than 300 radio stations have carried his nationally syndicated radio programs. On television, Lowell worked for 4 years as commentator and reporter on KCET-TV, the West Coast Production Center of the Public Broadcasting Service, PBS, in Los Angeles. He is co-author with Craig Smith of 5 books, including their latest, Don't Bank on It. Again, it's Don't Bank on It by Lowell Ponte and Craig R. Smith. Lowell Ponte, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Bruce, it's a great honor to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, as we said, you and Craig R. Smith have gotten together and completed this 5th book, Don't Bank on It. How did this book come about?
This book came about because Craig, a close friend of his, had a very interesting experience. He walked into the bank. He said to the bankers, I need to withdraw $25,000 from my bank account, expecting, well, there'll be no problem. It's a tiny fraction of what she had in the bank. Instead, she was shocked to have them say, wait a minute, we can't do that. What do you need the money for? Do you have a note from your mother or father giving you permission to withdraw this money? I mean, they did everything they could to stonewall her being able to take out her own money. As we began to look into this, we found this is happening all over the world with many different banks. There is a kind of crunch being put on banks, a kind of financial control by which they're discouraged from giving people money. And in any event, it's becoming, in effect, a crime to have very much of your own money. Mm-hmm. Most people don't understand, your bank now is, among other things, required by the government to report any financial activity you engage in involving any significant amount of cash, like a withdrawal she was asking for, that if you are caught carrying around any significant amount of cash, you could be subject to asset forfeiture. The government will ask you, why do you have this money? And if you don't have a perfect causal chain of ownership to prove that the money is legally yours, the government will simply take it. Now, I mean, weird, weird things are going on in the economy, and it turns out that the bank you and I grew up thinking of as the safest place to keep our money has become the most dangerous place, mm-hmm. not only because of these laws, but for a host of 20 different reasons that we discuss in Don't Bank on It. For example, you don't even own your bank account anymore. Effectively, your bank account now is deemed by the government for purposes of putting a penalty on the bank of some kind as being an asset of the bank. And as people discovered in Cyprus, as people discovered recently in Greece, if the government decides it needs that money, it will simply seize it. It will treat your deposit in the bank as the bank's money. And you may have very little recourse to that. Also, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. We've always been taught that that little gold seal in the window saying we will protect accounts up to $250,000 now, that that means something. In fact, the FDIC, if it pulled every financial emergency string it has, can only cover one out of every $14 that it claims to insure in American bank accounts. And that would be with the full help of the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve giving it additional money. So you're not really insured either. And we begin to discover there is a long trail of how the banks became as odd as they are today, from the banks that first began in ancient Babylon 3,000 years ago, where the banks were the temples and what people stored there was their grain to be protected by the gods from everything, I suppose, except mice. To the kind of banking that the Hebrew children discovered when they found themselves in exile in Babylon. Many of them apparently got involved in banking there, too. To what we have today, which is fractional reserve banking, where you lend the bank your money, and the bank immediately turns around and lends that money long-term to somebody else as a mortgage or whatever. So that you may think your money's safe, but you walk into a bank and say, I want my money. If more than 50 or 100 people a day did that, your bank would be broke. Your bank simply doesn't have the money on hand. And the banks are now acting very, very strange in a whole host of ways that we discuss in this book. So is, for that matter, the Federal Reserve. I mean, not that long ago, Germany went to the Federal Reserve and said, we'd like a small fraction of our gold that's been held on deposit in the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And the government looked at them and said, well, it will take us 7 years to give you back your gold. And the Germans said, well, in the meanwhile, can we at least come and audit our... No, you will not be allowed to audit your gold. Well, can we at least come and stand 20 feet away and look at our gold? No, said the Fed, you will not be allowed to do that. Very strange things are happening.
I guess it was prophetic that Jesus beat up the money changers.
Part of the challenge that Jesus addressed to people, they said, you know, shall we pay this coin in tax to Caesar? Jesus said, well, take out the coin and show me whose face is on it. Oh, well, the face of Caesar is on it. Well, then render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. Mm-hmm. There's another thing, though, if you open the Bible to the book of Revelation, that is kind of unnerving. People for 2,000 years said, what's this stuff about you having the mark of the beast, without which you are not allowed to buy or sell? How can that possibly be? Boys and girls, pull out your credit cards now. You're going soon not to be able to buy anything with cash. We are being pushed headlong at high speed into a cashless society in which the only transactions permitted will go through government-related computers. And those computers will be able to shut off your credit instantly. Those computers will be able to monitor everything you do. All your financial privacy will suddenly become trackable and taxable. And the government will begin imposing a 20% tax on every transaction. I mean, if your son or daughter graduates from high school and you want to give them $100 to congratulate them, that will suddenly wind up as $80 by the time the government taxes it, because you will no longer be able to hand it to them in cash. You can only hand it to them via electronic means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's very rapidly where we're headed now. The government does not want you to have cash at all. That's why they're making it harder and harder to get. That's why they're making it a virtual crime to to transact things in cash. Ask former Republican Speaker of the House Denny Hastert about this. He was apparently withdrawing money from his bank account to pay a blackmailer who purportedly had incriminating information about him, only to find himself arrested simply for having this amount of cash taken out of the bank, and the bank not able to report adequately what he was doing with the cash.
Well, I know my bank now, within the last 6 months, they put out a little sign in front of the teller that said, if you want to deposit money, not just withdraw it, deposit money, you need to show your ID. You
well, it's a transaction. And I mean, they've implemented first the 1970 Bank Secrecy Act. Interesting, because I was a young journalist in Washington, D.C. in 1970. I remember just how weird things were there in that time when the government frantically needed more money to pay for the Vietnam War. And so they were beginning to squeeze everybody and everything they could to increase government revenue. This was under the Nixon administration, of course, the same Richard Nixon who gave us the Environmental Protection Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act and other acts that have massively increased the power of lawyers in the government. Mm-hmm. We now are in a world where our financial privacy is nearly zero. What they've implemented since then is part of bank secrecy, requiring your bank to report on your financial activities and transactions. They now have added a thing called structuring to that. Whereas in the past, it was illegal for you to withdraw more than $10,000 without a report being filed. Now, it is against the law to withdraw an amount smaller than $10,000 being done in increments to evade reaching the $10,000 limit. So we have this strangely Orwellian law where if over a course of 12 months you withdraw a total of $10,000 in cash and don't file a report on it, you may be in violation of federal law.
So what is their justification for this? Are they saying this is an act to try to catch terrorists?
They say it's to catch terrorists. They say it's to catch criminals. Part of what the Bank Secrecy Act did was usher in the age, the magical age of FinCEN. FinCEN is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And FinCEN does all kinds of peculiar things. Its computers, for example, are interfaced with Interpol, with the IRS, with the FBI, and a whole lot of other entities. And what they do, among other things, is they monitor your lifestyle. So, for example, if on your tax form you say, I've been making $35,000 a year, but you're buying things at the lifestyle level of someone who is making $45,000 a year, FinCEN knows that. FinCEN monitors and flags these things. And so your lifestyle can be used as a cue to get you audited by the IRS. And I mean, you take your credit card out. This is another reason they want everything electronic. You take out your credit card and buy a sofa for $800. Mm-hmm. 2 seconds later, that's in the government computer. They are following, they're monitoring your purchasing patterns. And they have the ability to do that for everybody. I mean, they may not do it for folks like you or me, but for anyone who has the potential to be a criminal. Oh, and then under the Obama administration, of course, they added Operation Chokepoint, in which the government, remember, has virtually nationalized the banks. The government has so much regulatory power, it just tightens the screws, and the banks all know this, they're scared to death. When the government comes to them and says, you do something on our order, the banks will jump and say, yes, sir. And so the Obama administration and Eric Holder, when he was Attorney General, issued a list of about 40 enterprises that the government says we deem these inherently dangerous or suspicious. And therefore, Mr. and Mrs. Banker, any enterprise engaged in any of these activities, we want you to watch. And if you agree with us that they've done anything financially suspicious, in even the tiniest way, I want you to shut off their bank accounts. Mm-hmm. Now, you notice, these are enterprises that have not been accused of a crime. They have certainly not been convicted of a crime. but the government was ordering the banks, destroy them financially for us on your whim. If and remember, if they do something that we deem suspicious and you haven't reported and already acted, we're going to come down on you, Mr. Banker. Now, what kind of businesses was the Obama administration after? Oh, selling guns, selling ammunition, all the things that the Obama administration ideologically hated were put on this list.
Yeah.
And these companies were all targeted, and your banker was supposed to act arbitrarily, capriciously, and beyond the law just to crush companies doing this under Operation Choke Point. We document, by the way, all of this in great detail and footnote it for you in Don't Bank on It.
Now, as you said, a lot of this has happened during the Obama administration. Is it as simple as voting them out? I mean, would Republicans be able to reverse all of this?
Basically, these are people who have a great love of government revenue and government bigness. Republicans may want it for the military, and Democrats may want it for social welfare, but they both have an interest, most of them, in government staying big. After all, once they're elected, they are the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of these people get elected, Republicans in particular, by saying the government is a cesspool. And then as soon as they get there, they decide, this isn't a cesspool, this is a hot tub. And we're here to party.
Yeah.
They develop an immediate love of power and wealth and having their limousines and having their ability to, for people much better than themselves, by which I mean the heads of successful companies serving the public, to come and grovel before them.
Yeah.
In committees, because the government is now so powerful it could pretty much destroy any company it wished on a whim. And it's unfortunate. See, what we've discovered in doing these five books, they used to say that the power to tax is the power to kill. And it certainly is true. That's what one of our early Supreme Court Chief Justices said, John Marshall. However, today, the power to regulate is also the power to kill.
Yeah.
And the power to regulate is now basically unlimited. You remember when the Democrats not long ago exercised what was called the nuclear option by doing away with the gerrymander and other so that no one could stop an Obama action. And the first action Mr. Obama took when this occurred was to completely pack the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. That was the court that was there to check and limit government regulation. Since then, there is no regulation the government can't pass or implement. So it's rather spooky. I mean, it means we now have a completely capricious dictatorship in the U.S.
Where do you see gold going in the next few years?
Well, it could really only go up from here in the long run. You have to remember, gold is the other global reserve currency. It is the one universal currency that's always, for 5,000 years, been accepted everywhere as money. So you can't really extinguish the value of gold in the long run. You can try to push it down, and what our government's been doing is drive people out of every safe haven available. For example, people like me used to say, I don't care if it doesn't pay a lot. I want the safety of putting my money in a bank account. Well, the government is now preparing to confiscate your bank accounts anyway, as we lay out in the book. But more than, in fact, technically, legally, they already have, in a sense. You're no longer the guaranteed owner of your bank account. But they are carrying out a systematic policy in the Federal Reserve called financial repression. That sounds extreme. That's actually a formal technical economic term. And by it, economists mean the government is deliberately holding the rate of inflation higher than whatever rate you are going to be paid as interest in the bank. What that means is inflation is eating up your money in the bank faster than interest being paid you by the bank is offsetting it. In other words, every day you have a bank account, you're losing money or you're losing purchasing power because of that. In fact, Craig and I wrote a whole book called The Inflation Deception about how inflation is systematically used as a tax here. But as to gold, coming back to your question, gold is another of the safe havens that the government has played exotic games with paper gold and other things to try to hold the value back. And obviously, central banks around the world have been more than happy to go along with that because it lets them buy gold at a lower price than would otherwise exist. So they adore the game. Now, you've been seeing Russia massively acquiring gold. You've seen China massively. China has just more than doubled its gold reserves in the last, 12 months. Mm-hmm. And they had huge gold reserves to begin with. So the countries know what's coming, and they know that this October there's going to be a massive shock as suddenly the International Monetary Fund says, we are taking away the U.S. government's sole monopoly as the world reserve currency, which was a status that meant if Poland wanted to buy a barrel of oil from Saudi Arabia, by the agreement of Saudi Arabia, they had to buy that oil in dollars, which means they had to acquire U.S. dollars to do the buying. And that gave us a tremendous advantage. That advantage is about to go away. Mm-hmm. And when it does, we have been just riding with our nose just above the rate of recession in the country. You notice we're running at 2% or less growth, we just discovered in recent weeks, and have been since 2011, meaning they've lied to us through the 2012 and 2014 elections, claiming the economy was doing better than it was. Well, the economy is not in good shape by any means, and it's only going to get worse. The economies are sliding downward all over the world right now. And the dollar, while it's temporarily advantaged by that, in the long run, things are going to get very dicey, especially if the Chinese yuan, or even worse, a Russian or Chinese gold currency is introduced this coming October. That will devastate the dollar in the economy.
Sober.
By the way, if people would like to learn all about this, I know this is complicated stuff we're laying out. We would be more than happy, Bruce, to give all of your listeners, absolutely free and postage paid, a copy of our 256-page book, Don't Bank on It, The Unsafe World of 21st Century Banking, so you can see just how you've been tricked, how you've been manipulated by this, and how you can protect yourself. And if people would like that, all they need to do is call a toll-free number. We'll be happy to give it to you. Just leave your name and number. We'll get back to you. 1-800-630-1494 is that number, 1-800-630-1494. Or a way to remember it, think of Columbus sailing the ocean blue in 1492, but not quite. It's 1-800-630-1494. Now, we do this because, frankly, Craig is a brilliant, ultra-successful entrepreneur. He's built a whole financial empire in the last 30 years, starting with $50. He is a business genius, but all he cares about is not making a few dollars from selling a book. It's rather to protect his children and grandchildren and ours from having the republic collapse here. In other words, we're trying to restore and protect the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, sound money, getting back to the values of the founders here who built an economy on freedom and gold. And if you would like to get the book, it's absolutely free. Look it over. You have nothing to lose. You have a whole life of economic greater security to gain. So 1-800-630-1494 is the number. And thank you for discussing this. You know, not all hosts have the courage to talk about these things.
Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Well, Bruce, thank you for being a beacon of light in a dark world for people.
And joining us this week is Mary Sutherland. Mary Sutherland is a hands-on researcher and the creator of one of the largest websites on the internet with hundreds of pages providing information on the paranormal, UFOs, ancient races and their cultures, sacred sites and PowerPoints of the world, underground tunnels and cave systems, dimensional worlds, and other topics. The governor of Kentucky commissioned her as a Kentucky colonel for her work on the ancient sites of Kentucky. For the last 5 years, she has been exploring, mapping, and documenting the ancient underwater structures of Rock Lake near Astalan, For the last 14 years, she has been documenting the ancient sites around Burlington, Wisconsin. Truth is her passion. She believes it is through truth that we will break ourselves free of our present entanglements in life. When we become free, we will create our own personal story of the hero's journey suggested by Joseph Campbell. Mary Sutherland, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm honored.
Well, it's great to have you on.
I'm honored.
Now, you do a lot of interesting research. How did this all come about?
Well, I think everything kind of falls into play. People like myself, we find a passion and go with it. And ancient history has always been a passion of mine, especially prehistory. And especially, you know, my work with the red-haired giants and the history, the prehistory of North America.
Yeah. Now, before we get into that, as your bio suggests, you were commissioned as a Kentucky colonel. I almost imagine the prize is like a bucket of chicken. But what happens when you become a Kentucky colonel?
Well, actually, that's Colonel Sanders got his colonel was through, because he was a Kentucky colonel as well.
Huh.
But it's a commission that has been honored, you know, given honor to my work, you know, from the governor, you know. But actually, it is a ongoing status. If there was ever a war or anything here, you know, in the States, you know, that I am an actual colonel.
Now, we've had Frank Joseph on our show many times, and I understand you were scuba diving with Frank. What were you two up to?
Well, Frank and me, you know, through the years of, you know, both having respect for each other's work and have ended up as good friends. And you know, he feels the same way about ancient America as I do. And there's a place here in Wisconsin. It's called Absalon. It's over by Lake Mills. And there's a lake right there. It's a bottomless lake. There's always been stories of the sightings of, what do they call that one? It's one of those lake monsters, mm-hmm. you know, but, it's something like a Nessie. And anyhow, you know, there's always been stories about that, and then things, portals over there, you know, things appearing and disappearing. And that this was the ancient home of these people that were the precursors for the Aztec and the Mayan Indians, and that so there at Lake Mills or Rock Lake, what it's called is it's kind of like a bowl. And and when they lived, when these ancient people lived there, they had a huge city. And then when they left and went down to Mexico, what they did is they blew up the dike, letting all the water come back in mm-hmm. and fill up that bowl. And you know, and they did a really good job of it, because you know, people are still trying to find the old structures there. But when Frank and I first started working together on this, finding and mapping out these underwater structures of Rock Lake, we were out there on a pontoon, you know, with our scuba diving equipment, and the DNR came out. Now, they're still arguing about if there's a pyramid there. You know, this is the consensus. One pyramid, and is it there or isn't it there? But while we were out there with a few other researchers, an agent for the DNR came out, you know, on a ski boat, and to check out, see what we were doing. And we told him we were looking for underwater structures. And he said, you know, between, you know, him the fence post, that that the DNR had actually documented over 1,100 structures. Not one that they're still arguing about, but actually over 1,100. And he said, I'll be right back. He got back on his ski boat, went back to the water edge and to where his car was parked, and he came back again with a map showing us where all these underwater structures were. And, So, and he had told us, he says, well, you know, if you want to find some of this, he says, I'd suggest looking over at this one spot. And so after he left, Frank just looked at me. He says, let's go the opposite direction. I says, okay. So we went to this other area that nobody had really researched and, excavated. So anyhow, we were sitting over there. It was at the end of the day, and we'd used up most of our air in the tanks. And we had an underwater camera with a monitor on the boat. And the camera hit a pyramid down there. And that we were able to see. I think there were seven of us. And anyhow, it was a black to me it looked obsidian because it but anyhow, so I'm going to go with obsidian. But it was a black obsidian pyramid, and at the capstone it had gold hieroglyphs.
Wow!
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Just an amazing. And we don't know how high it actually was because we didn't, we have yet to figure out how much silt is actually sitting there at the bottom of that lake.
And again, we're speaking with Mary Sutherland, and you're the author of The Red-Haired Giants. How did you find out about these folks?
Well, I was the first one out there that even started writing about these red-haired giants. I started my research on them, I think, about, it's been close to 14, 15 years ago, maybe even 16. And I remember how, I put it out there on the internet, I called them the red-haired race, and I got so much heat from all the researchers, the audacity, of Mary Sutherland even writing about such a thing, and proclaiming that there was a race, an actual red-haired race, and who is this woman, that she can say something like that. But I never backed down on it. I knew that they were there, I was writing about it. I wasn't going to give up on it. And now today there's millions of sites,
right,
based off the work that I started.
What do we know about this race? Was it civilized?
It was very civilized. It was actually more civilized than what we have today. I shouldn't say more civilized than what we have today, but definitely high tech. They were astronomers. They were into agriculture. They set up these fortresses. They would create like a city. They were called stone builders because they'd actually build cities of stone. And they'd also build mounds too, ancient mounds. But they would build these cities, and then they would put like a fortress around them. The Native American Indians used to come in, and trade with them as well. But they set up these canals, man-made canals, that would be attached to the river systems, and so they'd be able to transport, their products, import and export products, through the river system. Like here, they take you down, we got the Mississippi, and then the Fox River, and so they could transport, their ware all the way down into the Gulf of Mexico. And from there it'd be shipped out, And that's where, you hear, them also being compared to the Phoenicians. And they were also, in my book I tell about their connection to Solomon, because Solomon was, he had his people over here, and they were mining, the copper, for the Temple of Solomon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, there's enough facts on it, and in my book, I always use my references, So it's not something, that, I've kind of, kind of pieced together in my own mind and came up with my own conclusion. It's based on facts, evidence, you know, and I put down those facts and evidence just like I would if it was a court case, mm-hmm. you know, to prove that these giants were here. And my book is a little bit different than what you're seeing out there, because the books that you're seeing out there now is just pretty much trying to prove that these giants existed. And I think that I've shown that they've existed, you know, through, you know, I have like one chapter of, you know, ancient burial mound or burial sites that had been dug up, you know, and then explaining what was found in each and every one of them. But I took it further because what I wanted to do is I already know, you know, and a lot of people already know this now that these giants did exist here in North America. But what I wanted to do was go with tradition. What were their traditions? You know, what made them tick? What, you know, what was their family life like? What was their religions like? You know, how many of them were here? What happened to them? What is their connection with the Mayans and the connection with the Aztec and their connections to, you know, world trade, you know, because basically they were Atlanteans, you know, they were a branch off the Atlanteans, the survivors. Barry and Absalon, anyhow. I mean, they could have been here for a million years, for all we know. But we do think that we have discovered their end date, you know, of about around 10,000, 11,000 B.C. Mm. You know, that something happened to these people, you know. Great wars were taking place at that point of time, and they just kind of picked up and left and went and started, you know, a new civilization called the Aztec.
Were they all red-haired, or was it just the giants that were in this area?
Well, the people of Cain carried the red-haired gene, and so, you know, and that and these red and many of your giants were red-haired. But, you know, in my book, I even tell about Noah being a giant. Mm-hmm. You know, many of the people at that point of time were giants, you know, had giant stature. And then there was, you know, so, yeah, you pretty much have to read my book to really get the grasp of, you know, of who these giants were. But basically, in this book, I'm focusing right on the red hair. But there was another group of blonde-haired, and there was a group of black-haired as well, but my focus is on the red-haired giants. They came from the line of Cain.
Uh-huh. So are these what some researchers call Nephilim?
That's what a lot of the researchers are calling them is, yeah, Nephilim, you know, because, and then, you know, in the Bible it says something, or in the ancient text as well, it says that the angels came down and bred with the daughters of Cain. And from that came giants, men of renown, you know. So I guess it's how you want to define the word Nephilim. A lot of people like to call the Nephilim the fallen angels. Well, if they were the fallen angels, then they wouldn't have been the giants because the angels were, you know, having babies by the women of Earth or the daughters of Cain. Mm-hmm. But they did, but you know, them coming together did produce giants.
These giants, though, they were worldwide, weren't they? So did they scatter from Atlantis? Is that what happened?
The Atlanteans were giants, and they were spreading out, you know, and, you know, spreading their empire out. This land, after the deluge, was right, the first dry land right after the deluge was right here in North America. And the geologist reports say that while everything else, well, all the other countries were still underwater, there was dry land running from Canada down through Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, all the way down into the Appalachian Mountains. And so if this was the first dry land, you know, the oldest, well, they reported it was the oldest dirt mm-hmm. in the world. And if that's the case, then everything would have been born here in North America. And then, you know, as everything, you know, as the population grew, they spread out. The first migration that, you know, archaeologists and anthropologists don't really want to talk about, it was the migration of the people, the gods of wisdom, which were also the Nagas, an Indian term, you know, the first migration was here in North America, and then it was like they spoked out like a wheel, you know, going to, you know, finding pods of, you know, civilization and re-educating them and, you know, and creating all these new civilizations, rebuilding the, you know, new from the old. Because even after the deluge, there was a lot of survivors. And so their job was to go out there and find them. Mm-hmm. And even in Egypt, the Egyptian papers talk about Thoth coming to Egypt and starting a great civilization. Well, and they explain that God, Thoth was a god of wisdom that came across the sea from the land of the west. Well, if you look at a map, the land of the across the sea from Egypt west would have been North America. There would have been nothing else but, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if a person really wants to dig, you know, the information's all out there, you know. And that's what my job is I used to be at one point in time, a journalist and that's what I used to do is come, you know, fit the pieces of a puzzle together to, you know, find the story. And that's what I do today with my books is I research all these ancient texts, books that have been long forgotten. You know, I don't really focus very much on what we find on the internet. I try to go to the ancient Vedic texts and things that I find around the world, you know, and that have, like I said, have been lost. And I take that information and I try to put it together and try to find that common denominator, that thread of truth that runs through, you know, that keeps being repeated over and over and over again. And from that, you know, I have come up with my theory, which I don't really believe is a theory. I think it's truth, but that this was the motherland, North America was, and that it was populated according to the ancient Vedic text, Mahabharata. This was the homeland of the giants. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, like I said, my book, The Red-Haired Giants, actually focuses on the red-haired giants, not the blackheads or the blondes or anything. Maybe I've been doing I've got about 6-7 books out and there's a 5-book series I'm putting out and let's see, this is Red-Haired Giants is book 3, I believe, out of the 5 books. And it's called, the series is called In Search of Ancient Man. And so the Red-Haired Giants focuses on North America, but the book I'm working on now focuses on the Brahmins and Abraham and the Anunnaki and the Middle East. And then I'm going to take that information and pull it around and fit it with the information I have of North America and then incorporate, you know, like Ireland and, you know, and Germany and, you know, different ones in there, you know, to show that, you know, who these ancient people were, you know, and try to help people to understand, you know, how religion came about and, you know, what the ancient mysteries really is and how this all works with lost information from these ancient people. You had mentioned something about me being a Kentucky colonel. Well, that's what that was all about, is my husband Brad and I had went down to Kentucky, and we were in search of ancient Atlantean temples. And we found them, you know, and documented them. And of course, the governor felt it important enough, the work that we did, that he commissioned me as a Kentucky colonel.
But so. does the state of Kentucky recognize these buildings as Atlantean temples?
Well, they recognize my work.
I see.
And, you know, and my research, yeah.
Do you agree with other giant researchers that believe that the Smithsonian has a, conspiratorially hid...
That's where these researchers, remember, I was the first one that actually put this out, you know. So basically what you're seeing a lot now is people, reporting things that I had already put out there. But yes, that's what I had originally wrote, and I'm still sticking with it. And I had come across an old paper, about 16 years ago, where they had, it was written about how the Smithsonian, what they were doing is they were finding these giants and putting them on barges, you know, the skeletal remains of these giants, I should say, putting them on barges and actually dumping them into the ocean, wow. just to get rid of them, because they didn't want people knowing about these giants. And, you know, and people say to me, they'll say, well, why are they doing this with the giants? And I said, well, you know, it's kind of, to me, as far as the government is run, it's run like military, need-to-know basis. Mm-hmm. Because they're not sharing information with us on UFOs, they're not sharing information on paranormal, time travel.
There were newspaper articles about giants in the 1800s, but there were also hoaxes within those newspapers, such as in 1835 there was a newspaper that said that there were people living on the moon, there was a colony there. And it was called the Great Moon Hoax of 1835. So do you think we should take these stories seriously from the 1800s that talked about giants being found?
I do. It's like I tell everybody, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
It's like even today, you know, people put out disinformation to throw people off the track. Mm-hmm. And as far as these stories, these newspaper stories go, you know, they wasn't there. The people today, they wasn't there in those days. Mm-hmm. How do they know that they were, stories that they made up? Why would they be making these stories up? I mean,
I think the reason why they faked the news stories was to sell newspapers.
I think that the people in the 1800s were a lot more truthful than what you're finding in the media today. Today we know the media is making things up, you know. I mean, yeah, there's going to be some hoaxes out there, you know, they're called tall tales, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, so yeah, there was some stories out there, just for the fun of it, that they were telling. But I think on a whole, as far as these giant bones being uncovered, because that's where I got a lot of my information, was from the, these newspaper clippings, I find in the archives from the newspapers.
And again, we're speaking with Mary Sutherland. She's the author of The Red-Haired Giants. Now, before we go, Mary, where can people find you on the Internet?
Well, they can, I do a lot of my teaching using Facebook and even do previews of my books that I'm working on. So they can go to Facebook/Sci-Fi Cafe, and that's SciFiCafe, one word. Or they can go to where they can purchase all my books autographed on my website, burlingtonnews.net/books. Or they can go to Amazon, of course, and just type it in search, and the Red-Haired Giants will, pop up. And they can purchase it through Amazon as well. And then, of course, my main site is burlingtonnews.net.
Now, Mary, thank you so much. I've never spoken to a Kentucky colonel before, so it's an honor to speak with you, and I wish you all the success in the world.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Great. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bruce Collins at The Bruce Collins Show. Thank you so much for joining us each and every week, Fridays at midnight on WWPR 1490 AM. We would ask that you would support all of your favorite charities that help to spread the gospel, clothe the needy, and feed the hungry. You can do that as thanks for listening to our program. We ask of no monetary payback from you, only your listenership and your dedication to making the world a better place. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for joining us here at the Bruce Collins Show, where you can find us every Friday night at midnight here at WWPR 1490 AM. Remember, God loves you. We do too. Don't give up.